It's Here and Now. The debate triggered by yesterday's Iraq Study Group report is in full flower today. In a moment, members of the commission testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee. We'll have more on that. But we begin at the White House, where President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair, early allies in the war, met this morning and then met the press.
Nick Robinson, BBC News. Mr. President, the Iraq Study Group described the situation in Iraq as grave and deteriorating. You said that the increase in attacks is unsettling. That will convince many people that you're still in denial about how bad things are in Iraq and question your sincerity about changing course.
It's bad in Iraq. Does that help?
Why did it take others to say it before you've been willing to acknowledge it to the world?
In all due respect, I've been saying a lot. I understand how tough it is, and I've been telling the American people how tough it is, and they know how tough it is. And the fundamental question is, do we have a plan to achieve our objective? Are we willing to change as the enemy has changed? And what Baker Hamilton study has done is it shows a good ideas as to how to go forward.
Richard Wolff is senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He joins us from the White House now that the conference is over. Richard, tough questions there. What was the rest of the tone of the conference? Did these two leaders seem knocked back on their heels a bit or energized? How would you characterize it?
You know, I've been watching these two leaders for many, many years, and I have to say they are remarkably constant in their belief in the mission. And the importance of the sort of ideological struggle that they describe. But, you know, the tough questions are not whether it's worth fighting, but how to fight and how to succeed. And there wasn't a whole lot of discussion about that other than it's got to be worth sticking with.
Right. We understand that both Bush and Blair agreed, in fact, kept bringing up one point of the panel's conclusion, that a resolution of the Iraq conflict is tied to reducing tensions between Israel and the Palestinians. Now, a lot of senators today are disagreeing with that linkage. We'll hear more about that. Israel's prime minister disagrees as well. What are Bush and Blair saying?
Well, this is a primary issue for Tony Blair. He has long wanted to increase the political capital being invested in this, certainly on the part of the White House. And he hasn't had a whole lot of success. He certainly tried to do this before the war in Iraq, before the invasion, and he's still trying to do it now. But there is a deep skepticism within the White House, in fact, a downright opposition to the notion that somehow regional diplomacy will just clean everything up in Iraq. I mean, don't get me wrong, the White House wants to see an independent Palestinian state and peace between Israelis and Palestinians. But like members of Congress, they don't believe there's a direct link between the violence in Iraq and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Mm.
Well, Richard, as you well know, a key part of the Iraq report was urging the U.S. to talk with Iran and Syria. And here's what the president had to say about that.
If we were to have a conversation, it would be this one to Syria. Stop destabilizing the Sonora government. We believe that the Sonora government should be supported, not weakened. Stop allowing money and arms to cross your border into Iraq. Don't provide safe haven for terrorist groups. We've made that position very clear. And the truth of the matter is that these countries have now got the choice to make. If they want to sit down at the table with the United States, it's easy. Just make some decisions that'll lead to peace, not to conflict.
President Bush is saying to Syria, stop interfering in Lebanon, the Sonora government there. Richard Wolff, you know, what else? What are some of the other things that, you know, jumped to mind that came up today?
Well, just to take that point for a second, I think there's no question that the Prime Minister, the British Prime Minister, takes a different approach to talking with Iran and Syria. He sees more value in it, although he also opposes the notion that you can simply ignore what Iran and Syria are doing in terms of arming and funding terrorists and the militias in Iraq. But there is a difference of emphasis there. And again, also a difference of emphasis on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. One thing I know that didn't come up that Tony Blair is focused on in this visit is climate change. It didn't come up in the press conference, but Tony Blair has been meeting with members of Congress to try and push ahead on addressing climate change. Not much signs that he got anywhere with the White House on that today.
Right. Well, and it's also probably a topic that's not going to be on the front burner for a while because of the Iraq situation. And just to remind us briefly of the British situation in Iraq. They've got 7,000 troops there, troops in Afghanistan as well, and fighting harder there than they've been because of the resurgent Taliban. What's Tony Blair's mandate? Has there been, you know, the equivalent of a commission in Britain, you know, making demands about Britain's role in Iraq?
Well, there have been successive reports and studies, but essentially the political mood has changed so dramatically that Iraq is really the direct cause of Tony Blair leaving office much earlier than he would like to, which will be at some point next year, probably the early part of next year. And the strong expectation in London is that British forces will come down from those levels. Actually, I think it's slightly lower than 7,000 already. Mm. Remember, the high point at the start of the invasion, British troops were around about the 40,000 level mark. So really, there's an expectation that British troops will leave Iraq sometime over the next 12 months, and that the focus is going to be much more on this very difficult fighting in Afghanistan, where British troops are taking a significant share of the burden in the NATO alliance.
Well, just one last question to you, Richard. You began by saying, you know, how you were noticing how constant these two leaders are in their belief in the mission in Iraq. And we wondered if you're seeing a president, at least in President Bush's case, trying to take control of the agenda. Last week, for instance, meeting with Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. He mentioned that meeting during today's news conference. But that, you know, attempt to sort of take control of the agenda didn't seem to work. Did it work today? Or are you seeing one, maybe two world leaders who have lost control of the agenda? Is it out of their hands? Is that the sense you get?
Well, they've certainly lost control of the situation in Iraq. But look, the White House has a plan over the next couple of weeks to roll out what the president referred a couple of times to as the new way forward or a new approach in Iraq. And this is going to culminate in a big set-piece speech, a big unveiling of the new strategy, the completion of his review of all the reviews inside the administration. And that's really the sort of public relations push to say to the American people, he's listened, he's adapted, but that the core mission is still worth sticking with and fighting for. Look, having lost the election, having obviously seen the spiral of violence worsen in Iraq, there is a deep frustration inside the White House about their ability to change events. But this is a president, like I said, who still believes in the mission and has 2 years left to prove that he can make a difference.
Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Richard, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now we turn to Andrew Bacevich, professor of international relations and history at Boston University. He's going to spend several minutes with us today taking a look at this story through a military prism. But first, Andrew, your reaction briefly to the presidential press conference.
Well, just listening to that conversation that you were having with Richard Wolff, and I'm struck by the fact that it's almost as if we have two parallel processes of disintegration. There's the disintegration of the situation in Iraq as the violence continues to worsen, and in a sense in Washington we have the disintegration of the Bush presidency. I mean, I'm struck by the extent to which the president's authority, especially in the aftermath of the November election, I think compounded now by the repudiation of his policies by the Iraq Study Group, his authority really is waning, and I'm not sure that he can gain control of policy in Washington any more than the United States can regain control of events in Iraq.
We want to talk more about that, but it has been a busy day in Washington. As we said, the Iraq Study Group co-chairs went before the Senate Armed Services Committee this morning. Former Secretary of State James Baker, former Congressman Lee Hamilton, insisting that the White House can't cherry-pick which issues it wants to deal with. Here's Lee Hamilton.
You cannot solve the Iraqi problem in pieces. And so you have to approach it comprehensively. If you think you can solve the problem of Iraq by manipulating the troop levels, I think you got it dead wrong. If you think you can solve the problem by economic reconstruction or political action, I think that's wrong too.
Andrew Bacevich, stay right there because joining us now, Pam Hess, who covers the Pentagon for UPI. Pam, what is Lee Hamilton saying here? How do you interpret that?
The Baker and Leigh Hamilton have come at this from a comprehensive point of view, and what's interesting to me is actually they're not just talking about Iraq, but rather the entire region, and that everything in the Middle East is connected. And it's something that we forget, that prior to World War I and certainly prior to changes after World War II, that whole area was undelineated the way that it is now. The Western powers got in there and carved it up artificially. We've forgotten that, and everything that happens in that region affects everything else. Those people don't feel like those lines exist.
Well, as you know, several senators took issue with that idea. Here's Joe Lieberman of Connecticut.
I'm skeptical that it's realistic to think that Iran wants to help the United States succeed in Iraq. Why is there any reasonable belief that the Iranians should do any of the things that you think they should do? And if they do, won't they ask us an unacceptable price, which is to allow them to go ahead?
Develop nukes? Yeah.
Exactly.
Senator, thank you. That's a very good question, and let me answer it this way. First of all, we specifically exclude any linkage to the nuclear proliferation issue. We say that should not be taken up in any discussion we might have with Iran. You're saying, why should we approach them? There are two reasons, in my opinion. One, we did so in Afghanistan, and guess what? They helped us. If we ask Iran to come and they say no, we in the Iraqi government, and they say no, then we will hold them up to public scrutiny as the rejectionist state that they have proven to be.
That was former Secretary of State James Baker responding. Pam Hess of UPI, a lot of resistance to this idea of including Iran and Syria, as you said.
Yes, what's interesting to me is that it seems that this administration and maybe even this Congress has failed to grasp exactly what diplomacy is. Certainly the Bush administration has this underlying belief that you don't sit down and negotiate until both sides are willing to do something. What Baker is saying is that, no, you sit down to talk to get the other side willing to do something, and that's where the horse trading comes in. And he said that discussing the Iraqi nuclear program would be separate from that. So I think what Baker is trying to do, you know, he was a very well-respected Secretary of State and huge in 1991 in getting Syria on board prior to the Persian Gulf War. He comes at this really from an adult perspective about what diplomacy is, which is engaging not just your friends but your enemies. That's the only point to it.
Right. And in fact, we heard Alan Simpson say this morning, even with the Soviet Union during the worst of the Cold War, we had a phone line
right, in
case we needed it. About a minute left, Pam Hess. What else jumped out at you after today's hearing?
Today's hearing, what jumped out at me is the recalcitrance of the Senate Armed Services Committee to get on board with that broader broader program. I mean, the regional diplomatic initiative. This is something that they said needs to get started before the end of December. So they said they've got about 3 weeks. Leigh Hamilton also warned that a tipping point is quickly coming. General Abizaid was up on the Hill a few weeks ago, and he also warned that there's about 6 to 8 months before things are going to change irrevocably in Iraq.
Pam Hess covers the Pentagon for UPI. Pam, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, we have Professor Andrew Basevich of Boston University standing by to take a look at this story through a military prism. We'll hear from John McCain, his reaction to the report, and get the professor's sense of, will this work militarily? More ahead, here and now. And now, here is some international reaction to the Iraq Study Group's recommendations. France's prime minister says it's a first step for the Americans to at last see the war for what it is. Germany's coordinator on relations with the U.S. called the report a course correction. From Egypt, an editor of a tabloid newspaper and critic of the U.S. said the report indicated the end of America. Mustafa Bakri urged Arab countries to capture the moment as America now is in its weakest period. Another newspaper in Egypt offered this headline, Bush Confesses Defeat in Iraq. Well, we're joined again by Andrew Basevich, professor of international relations and history at Boston University, talking again about these recommendations. And Professor, as we mentioned, we were just talking about the Senate Armed Services Committee. One of the main issues that was zeroed in was the issue of troop levels. As far as you can determine, first of all, remind us, what is the report saying? It is calling for a drawdown, but with no deadlines.
Well, no deadline, but looking to the first quarter of 2008 as the time in which the group would like to see all U.S. combat brigades out of Iraq. Now, one would have to emphasize that they're not proposing that all U.S. troops are removed. Indeed, their vision of ramping up the training effort, that is to say the effort to train and advise the Iraqis, looks to keeping tens of thousands of U.S. forces in Iraq long beyond 2008, but not to fight, to train and equip Iraqis.
Well, there were people who took issue with that because the idea is of, you know, if I'm reading it correctly, embedding American soldiers with Iraqi forces, and many, including John McCain of Arizona, said that's just plain dangerous, you know, and the panel replied, well, we'd have forces on the perimeter, you know, to protect them, but he still didn't like that idea of soldiers, U.S. soldiers being embedded with trained Iraqis. He also doesn't like the idea of the drawdown. Let's listen.
My studies and figures show that they are available for sustained deployment, at least in order to get the situation under control, number one. And I want to tell you something that I know that you know. There's only one thing worse than an overstressed Army and Marine Corps, and that's a defeated Army and Marine Corps. We saw that in 1973. And I believe that this is a recipe that will lead to, sooner or later, our defeat in Iraq.
Professor Basevich, your thoughts?
Well, I would like to see Senator McCain's figures about where these additional forces are going to come from. I'm very much in the camp that says that they really don't exist. It is certainly true that we could increase troop levels by 30 or 40 or maybe even 50,000 in the near term, but that would only be by preventing units from redeploying home after their year-long tour. So we could sort of increase things for a period of 6 months, and that would be it. There are those, I think they're honest, decent people, who say, yep, and we can win it in 6 months. I personally think that that's absurd.
Well, you know, I just want to jump in and say, you know, reading again, for instance, in the New York Times today, a compilation of thoughts from military people who all think that how could possibly troops do in a year what they haven't been able to do in four?
I don't think anybody... My reading of the Iraq Study Group is not that they're advocating this withdrawal of combat troops, reinforcing of the training effort, because they think this is just a really terrific idea. I think they're advocating it because there really are no great ideas, and this may be the least bad one.
Right, and this gets us to a conversation people are loath to have, and we just heard this from John McCain. It may be a sort of defeat, and it's funny. I was just I'm sorry, what you were going to say?
Well, I think, Robin, you're putting your finger on it exactly. I mean, my own view would be that the war is unwinnable, that the Iraq Study Group has recognized that, and so however much you may want to sugarcoat what's going on here, the fact of the matter is we're now in the business of trying to manage the consequences of a very large policy failure, and trying to limit the damage that failure does to our interests in the region. That's really where we are now.
It reminds me, for another reason, I was just researching some Robert McNamara, of course, the architect of the Vietnam War, and in his later years, someone who asked himself a lot of searching questions, and said at one point, you know, someone said, yes, but it was defeat. And he said, what's wrong with defeat? And, you know, the interpretation being, you know, as opposed to what? Staying and having people die. And
well, that's the other thing. When Senator McCain talks about the tremendously adverse consequences to the armed forces that resulted from Vietnam, to some degree, the armed services fell out because we stayed in Vietnam long after it was evident that was a failed enterprise. To some degree, one argument for beginning to withdraw U.S. combat troops now is to try to preserve them, to get them out before we suffer the kind of catastrophic consequences that happened from staying in Vietnam. You know, we stayed in Vietnam 5 years, basically, after the Tet Offensive, when we knew it was a lost cause.
And of course, there's another conversation we'll have another time, which is what happens to Iraq. But just briefly, we only have a little over a minute. The Iraq Study Group report also said that the military is underreporting violence in Iraq. We hear of so much violence. Your reaction to that, because it doesn't seem possible that it's worse even than we hear, but apparently the commission members found 1,100 acts of violence on a day when the U.S. recorded 93.
I can't really comment on that specifically, other than to give the sort of the historian's observation is that all war really is chaotic, and to imagine that any participant, one side in a war, can actually specifically gauge the level of violence, almost inevitably they're kidding themselves.
Closing thoughts in the few seconds we have.
Well, I mean, I think the big question here is the extent to which the president is going to be responsive to this study group and to those other internal studies that he has on. When you had that clip where he was issuing yet another ultimatum to the Syrian government, that kind of stubbornness does not encourage me.
Andrew Bacevich, professor of international relations and history at Boston University, author of The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War. Professor Bacevich, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Stay with us. Much more ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now. And now. How do you know you're right about the opinions or beliefs you hold? Can you trust your moral intuitions, your personal sense of what's right and what's wrong? Philosophers have long puzzled over how we make decisions that involve morals and morality, but now scientists at Harvard and MIT are getting into the act of trying to explain what's called moral reasoning. They say their early experiments show our moral judgments are not the rational decisions we might think. It's an emerging area of psychology and neuroscience that could change the way we think and might have implications for social policy and even the law. Here and Now's Alan Cockle reports on these early experiments in the science of moral reasoning.
You've got a position on abortion, gay marriage, the Iraq War. You believe you're right, of course. But how do you know?
We tend to rely rather uncritically on our moral intuitions. We tend to think that we just see the moral world as it objectively is.
Josh Green of Harvard University is one of a small number of scientists who are beginning to delve into the science of moral decisions.
And the more you learn about your moral intuitions, the more you realize that they're actually not as trustworthy as they seem.
Here's an example called the trolley problem. It's beloved of philosophers and psychologists alike, and it works like this. You're standing beside the trolley track. The train is bearing down with five people in its path. If it hits them, they'll be killed. But you have a choice. You can hit a switch to divert the trolley onto another track where there's one person standing. Do you hit the switch to save five lives at the cost of one?
Based on thousands and thousands of subjects, people consistently say yes to that question.
This is Harvard psychologist Mark Hauser.
Yes, it is permissible to flip the switch, leading the train onto the sidetrack where it will kill the one, saving the five.
But interestingly, one small change in the moral dilemma gives the opposite answer. This time, instead of a switch, you're on a footbridge over the tracks, standing next to a large man. To stop the train and save the five people below, your only option is to push the man off the footbridge and into the path of the train. Do you do it?
Here people say no.
So people say it's okay to pull a switch, send the trolley down a different track, and kill one person instead of five. Not okay to push somebody onto the track and kill one person instead of five.
That's right. So people are making a distinction, and typically when we ask people, why is one case permissible but the other is not, people typically do not have good reasons to explain those distinctions.
Mark Hauser and Josh Green say the trolley problem and similar scenarios prove that our moral judgments are not the rational decisions we might think. So Green decided to get inside the head to see how it all happens. He put volunteers into an MRI scanner, looking to see which parts of the brain were activated by the two versions, the switch and the footbridge version of the trolley problem.
And what we found is that the cases like the footbridge case seem to produce more of an emotional response, or at least more brain activity in brain regions that are associated with emotional response.
Recent studies in patients with brain injury confirm the role of emotion in moral choices, particularly these up-close and personal scenarios, such as having to push someone off a bridge. Other research from Mark Hauser's lab at Harvard provides evidence for the existence of some basic moral rules that Hauser says are shared across cultures. To take one example, one that relates to the trolley case, it seems that we always consider harm caused by physical contact with another person to be worse than harm caused without physical contact. Meanwhile, other scientists are considering other aspects of moral reasoning.
Okay, we're ready here, and we're going to start with the moral judgment task.
One of them, Rebecca Sachs at MIT, put me into the brain scanner.
Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
Okay, here goes.
Unlike the trolley scenarios, the moral decisions that Sachs is studying echo what goes on every day in courtrooms around the country. After all, our legal system is how society formally encodes morality.
So I'm laying on my back inside the scanner, reading a series of moral questions. Is it permissible in one case for someone who is skiing and sees a bunch of teenagers about to ski down what she believes is a dangerous slope? She thinks they're good skiers, she lets them go, but they aren't. They're novices and they crash into the sharp rocks. Is it permissible for her to have let them go? I said it was.
Scenarios like this one examine the connection between our judgments about moral culpability and our understanding of what other people believe. Every legal system in the world recognizes that if you make a reasonable mistake, you're not punishable. And Sachs has found a brain region that seems to go crazy when shown just this sort of scenario.
So these thoughts, the thoughts that led you to cause harm unknowingly, those thoughts really count. And we can see that in this brain region. So its response is high to any belief, but higher to false beliefs that led you to cause harm unknowingly.
Clearly, people differ in their moral judgments. Sachs says the psychology of moral reasoning might help explain why. Meanwhile, Josh Green at Harvard argues that this science-based approach to moral reasoning could change the way we think.
I think that what will happen is, as we come to understand how our moral thinking works, we're going to be led towards a style of thinking that seems kind of cold and inhuman and detached right now. This is the kind of thinking known as utilitarian thinking. And if we all were more utilitarian, that is, more focused on consequences and trying to make the world a better place, and less beholden to our intuitive emotional responses, we might all be better off.
Not everyone is a convert to the neuroscience of moral reasoning. Some philosophers think it's too early, the experiments too crude to be useful. But in a new book called Moral Minds, Mark Hauser argues that grabbing a small corner of the problem and moving forward is the right thing to do.
Our piece on the science of moral reasoning was produced by Here Now's Alan Cockle. For more, visit our website, here-now.org. We have time now for a couple of your thoughts on recent stories, one fittingly a debate about morality and mental illness. We reported recently on Malachi Richter, the Chicago man who set himself on fire in a suicide protest of the Iraq War, leaving his friends to wonder if it was his diagnosed depression or an act of righteous anger. Well, Dave Buell was moved by the story. He writes, he was probably depressed. Still, what sane person is not depressed by the Iraq War? I wonder if you remember Norman Solomon, the Quaker activist who also immolated himself. Vietnam War architect Robert McNamara said in the film Fog of War that that affected him very much. The Vietnam War suddenly shut down before I was drafted. I always wonder if Norman Solomon's death is what gave me back my life. Well, a lot of you wrote, after our visit with truck driver turned opera star Carl Tanner, because of a weird parallel between his story and a fictional one from the late Harry Chapin. John Bulger of Missoula, Montana, listening on XM Radio, writes, Carl Tanner recorded O Holy Night. Well, many years ago, Harry Chapin wrote a song about a fictional Mr. Tanner who ran a cleaning shop and whose friends also kept working on him to try music full time. Like Carl Tanner, he went to New York City to sing. And in Chapin's song, the fictional Mr. Tanner sings, you guessed it, O Holy Night. Well, we agree, that's weird.
Music was his life, it was not his livelihood, and it made him feel so happy, it made him feel so good, and he sang from his heart.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org, or give us a call and leave a message, 617-358-0397. You're listening to Here and Now.
Als das Kind Kind war, ging es mit hängenden Armen.
Wings of Desire is Wim Wenders' classic 1987 film about a pair of angels hovering over a divided Cold War Berlin, listening in on the thoughts of humans, taking notes on their every move. Well, the film has now landed on stage.
When the child was a child, he walked with swinging arms.
It's a co-production of the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Holland's Tuniel Group. It was Tuniel Group's Syrian-born director Ola Mufalani's idea to bring this iconic film from the big screen to the stage.
It's a masterpiece. I just thought it's a great movie till I became a director. And then angels appeared in my performances.
And did you connect it to the film at first?
Never. Never. Till 2 years ago, when an actress in Romeo and Juliet who played an angel, she kept on asking me, why am I in this play? What was your inspiration? And I found in my memory that it's because of Wings of Desire.
And what does the angel say to you? Because these angels are not in contact, at least that we can tell, with God. They don't talk about, you know, the big guy upstairs or anything like that. You're shaking your head no. So what does an angel represent to you?
He loves us humans for what we really are. They can read our thoughts. They know exactly, we can't lie to them. Huh? And they don't judge on you. Actually, what I want to say now and what I think they are saying is you are important. And I think if an angel even writes down for eternity that you crossed the street, there is an importance in your being which is so incredibly big.
It says they're there. And it's up to you to take their cue.
At a rehearsal, I spoke with actor Bernard White, who plays Damien, one of the angels who tries and often fails to help humans because, they have free will.
You know, that was the thing. It's like, I mean, I'm Catholic, and so a lot of my study was like the Catholic dogma on angels. And angels have free will also. And who knows what parties are going on behind us of angels.
Who knew? One of the places angels party? At the circus. In the film, Wim Wenders' camera wanders over all of Berlin. The staged production, including a circus aerial act, takes place around a single neon-lit snack truck, complete with a hot dog vendor. A two-person rock band speaks and sings the thoughts of the humans.
Are they still borders?
A Homeric woman, played by the old man in the library in the movie, wanders the stage.
Mankind, they lose its storyteller. And if mankind loses its storyteller, it also loses its child's game.
In the film Wings of Desire, there's a movie within a movie in which dozens of elderly extras play Holocaust survivors in a concentration camp. In the play, they've become four seniors on the stage. So I asked director Mufalani, who are they now?
They are the living history. In their memories, the angels read our world history.
Someone stole food from the dogs in the camps.
And the archer. And then the sun warm on your back, between your shoulder blades.
You can see a society in how they deal with their babies and with their living history. And this is why in the play it's very dominant when he says these are extras, extra humans. We don't need them for our economy anymore. So they are unimportant. And this I criticize from the bottom of my heart.
When was that? May? June of 45.
I'll have a story. I'll have a history.
What are the other challenges of taking a beloved film to stage? Well, when we come back, we'll find out. How do you play Peter Falk when Peter Falk played Peter Falk in the film? Who can play an aerialist, lovely and lonely enough to lure an angel? And also, what am I doing in this play?
The wings, you have to lift them, and you walk a diagonal to the mini heaven.
Oh, is that what that is?
The back wall, yeah.
Mini heaven.
where the angels are taught and the people go when they're dead.
And it's the little children's, the plastic children's chairs.
Yeah, it's like you start over again when you're dead as a baby angel.
More ahead, here and now. It's here and now.
But no! I... No! No!
An angel screams after a man jumps and commits suicide, despite the angel's best efforts. Simultaneously, an aerialist drops from the ceiling, wrapped in a 30-foot lifeline of white fabric, to begin her last performance. It's the new stage adaptation of Wings of Desire, a co-production of the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and the Tenniel Group Amsterdam. The play is set in the present day, but takes almost all of its dialogue from Wim Wenders' 1987 film.
I wish I could see your face.
Probably the most familiar face in the film is the craggy one belonging to Peter Falk, who plays himself as an actor on location in Berlin, but also an ex-angel trying to lure other angels back to Earth.
Here, to smoke, have coffee, and if you do it together, it's fantastic.
I've never seen the movie.
You've never seen it still?
No.
The equally craggy Stephen Payne plays the Falk role in the stage production.
Peter Falk is such a fabulous actor. I didn't want to get any of what he does in my head. And, you know, I just took my own take on it, sort of a freewheeler.
You pretty much say, I don't know what I'm doing.
You know, that's the most truthful line at the top of the show when I first come on and I say, you know, let's be real here. I don't even understand this character I'm playing. That is, I have to stop from laughing because it's the way I feel.
I don't even understand this character I'm supposed to be playing. Yeah, it's amazing how little I know about this part. I keep hoping to find it during the performances, but it hadn't happened yet.
About 95% of the play is dialogue taken directly from the film. Gideon Lester of the ART did the adaptation along with a Dutch writer and remembers his first reaction when director Ola Mafalani approached the Cambridge Theatre with the idea of staging the film.
We thought, well, she's totally crazy, because the film is not only one of the great film icons of the 20th century, but it's also very specifically about a time and place which we can't possibly bring to the stage.
Some of the cast are Dutch, some are English, but that really isn't the same divide, you know, at all that the wall was. So where is that divide?
Well, I think that there are many divides. It's quite self-consciously about the theatre in a way, and so part of the divide is between the stage and the audience. But I have to say also, Robin, that your function is partly to remind us of the divides that exist in the world.
I'm Robin Young. It's here and now.
Oh, yes. To my daily amazement, I appear in the play, a spiffed-up version of myself as a newscaster, and every night I'm struck by today's borders, real and imagined, between people.
A different reaction from Congress. Democratic Senator Carl Levin says he hopes the report is a death nail in the administration's Stay the Course policy. Senate Republican Whip.
Of course, immediately after you read the news, one of the characters explodes and asks you very violently, are there still borders? More than ever. And actually, it's text that comes from a taxi driver's interior monologue in the film. But the extraordinary thing about the screenplay is it feels totally current.
Are there still any borders? I'm talking to you. Are there still any borders? More than ever. Every goddamn street's a border. Every goddamn street's a border.
It's very much about the world at the moment. But, of course, we have many different kinds of flight in the production. Hovering above the stage for most of the time is this gloriously beautiful trapeze artist who does things that no human being should be able to do.
Bring the fabric in just a bit. Yeah.
Ma'am Spring is the Cirque du Soleil-trained aerialist and actress who plays Marion, the lonely trapeze artist who lures the angel Damien to Earth. But Ma'am soars on a long piece of fabric. At a recent rehearsal, she worked with her lifeline, securing it to the cable that will hoist her aloft.
What is this? What kind of fabric is this that you rely on?
It's a 2-ply tricot fabric. It's a heavy base nylon. It's rated for flying. They call it flyer's fabric.
So you trust it completely?
Yeah, I trust the integrity of the fabric. But you check it all the time for runs or any kind of like inconsistency, because as it's when it arrives, it's perfect. But there's so many things that happen on stage that can catch or pull on it, and that's when you really have to be careful.
Ma'am has carefully choreographed and calibrated her act. At this rehearsal, the rigger she worked with in Holland when the play first opened there has come to the States to train a Dutch cast member who will help secure the fabric.
Laten we zakken. Als jij die trap neerzet, dan ga je het zakken.
And an American rigger who will take over the job of pulling cables.
So she hangs upside down and then wiggle, wiggle.
Yeah.
Wiggle.
And then she's trying to get in again. And the moment she is in the cocoon, hits the bottom, you can start her just before she hits it. Otherwise you get bang, start.
Can we do it once?
Yeah.
I'm okay with that if we're watching. Just watch me coming back towards the lip of the caravan.
Yeah. You ready? So Hadewig is walking to the caravan. She comes to the caravan and she starts to sing now.
You're hanging on this long piece of white fabric, rolling up in it. And how would you describe it?
This is what they call like nouveau circus. Instead of using fabric as two long pieces, I use it as a loop.
Literally, the fabric hangs down in a big U, and you can sit in the base of it like a swing, or suddenly pull yourself up it.
Yes, and I really think it's much more sensual to watch. It certainly is more sensual to perform in.
Are you ever scared up there? Because every time I see it, it's 30 feet in the air. You've got your ankle wrapped around a piece of fabric. There's no safety net.
Yeah, no. If I don't do anything I'm afraid of. No, I'm not the least bit afraid. I really feel so much joy in the fabric, and in this particular performance in the fabric is really satisfying.
In the final moments of Wings of Desire, the angel Damien crashes to earth and becomes human. But then Marion takes him in her fabric back up to greater heights in a breathtaking aerial pas-de-deux.
Cassiel, something has happened. It's still happening. The unification. Who on this world can truly claim to have joined with another person? I have joined.
It's truly a sense of human contact and humanness that this show, Winds of Desire, has changed me internally in a way that I never expected. I found, for Marion, the character, seeking out an angel and finding her sense of truth as a character has shifted something in me on such a human level. And it's really going to change my life. My time in Amsterdam was amazing. I found such humanity in the other actors that I refuse to lose that.
The image that we created will accompany me at my death. And I will have lived inside it.
It's literally, of course, this story about an angel who overcomes a huge boundary and becomes human so that he can feel love and feel sensation. But over it all, there's a great transcendent beauty. And in the end, I think it's a story about what it means to be human and having your breath taken away by beauty at times of great suffering.
This wonderment. Man and woman has made a man of me.
Wings of Desire is a co-production of the American Repertory Theatre in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and the Netherlands Toneel Group Amsterdam. For more on the production, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.